Shimmer's Hill. It's just buttons away.
Okay. Good evening. We're on to Sedra Mishpatim, Parshat Mishpatim, after the giving of the Torah last week on Mount Sinai, Yitro. We then have a whole lot of laws in this Sedra. But at the end of the Sedra, at the end of the Parsha, there's a very sort of spiritual passage. You know, most of what the Parsha is talking about is very practical issues. But then, at the end, we have a section, so that's the passage from the Torah, which we've got as the first page. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. We're beginning there at, basically at the top, but verse 12, two lines down. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. God said to Moses, Ale Elai Ha-Ha-Ha-Ha, rise up to me up the mountain. Ve'heye sham, and you should be there. Ve'etnalacha, and I'll give you et luchot ha'eben, the tablets of stone, v'hatorah v'hamitzvah, and the Torah, the teaching, and the command, asher katavti lohoratam, which I've written to teach them, to teach the children of Israel. And so, Vayakam Moshe v'Yoshua m'shochtom, so Moses went up, got up, and Joshua, his servant, his aide, his assistant, Vayal Moshe el ha'alokim, and Moses went up the mountain of God. So there we have Moses going up the mountain, and then it goes on. And to the elders he said, Shvulanu vazeh, remain here, ad asher nashuv aleichem, until we come back to you. V'hinei Aaron v'chur emachem, Aaron and Chur will be with you. Mi bal dvarim yigash alehem. Anyone who has a problem should approach them and ask them what to do. V'yal Moshe laha, and Moses went up the mountain. V'yachas he'anan et ahar, and the cloud covered the mountain. The cloud hid the mountain. Vayishkon kvod Hashem al ha-Sinai, and the glory of God dwelt on Mount Sinai. Vayachaseyo he'anan, and the cloud covered it, covered the mountain. Sheshit yamim, for 6 days. And then, Vayikra el Moshe bayom ha-shvi'i mitoch anan. God called to Moses on the seventh day from within the cloud.
Where were all the rest of the people at that time?
So you got the bottom of the mountain, that's where all the people are. You've got the elders who are a bit higher with Aaron. You've got Joshua who's a bit higher. And then you've got Moses, right,
in the cloud.
Up, going up into the cloud, waiting 6 days. Because the cloud was so thick, he couldn't go into the cloud. That's one way of understanding it. And then God calls him. Now, Rashi says at this point that there was like a pathway made for Moses so that he was able to go into the cloud. So, Umare kvod Hashem ke'esh ochelet b'rosh ha'ah, the vision of the glory of God was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain. Le'enei b'nei Yisrael, to the eyes of the Jewish people, the children of Israel down below, they could see the fire on the mountain. Vayavur Moshe b'toch ha'anan, and Moses went into the cloud. Vayal elaha, and he went up to the mountain, up and up, hidden. Vayihi Moshe Baha, and Moses was on the mountain, Arba'im Yom, for 40 days, Va'arba'im Laila, and 40 nights. Alright, now that's really a key concept in Jewish thinking, the whole way in which we understand what Judaism is about, all sort of focuses on that event, with Moses going up onto the mountain, being there 40 days and nights. And the tradition is that that is where he got the entire Torah. The written Torah, the oral Torah, even that which a seasoned disciple will say, will discover in discussion with his teacher, generations later was all revealed to Moses on Mount Sinai. So here he's going up into this incredible atmosphere in order to get the entire Torah. Now the discourse focuses on this step where he's moving up, and there's like a pathway for him in the cloud. The cloud sometimes described as smoke, as if it was thick smoke. And so there is the that's the moment, or that's the vignette, you know, that's the image that the mima, that the discourse is focusing on. And we're going to try to explore this discourse. It was it's an unedited discourse, so it was said by the Rebbe and written down, transcribed by people who heard it and were able to remember the whole thing. An amazing feat.
Did the Rebbe go through it afterwards?
Well, this one, no. See, this is unedited. There are many discourses which are edited, but this one is not edited.
Is it because he gave it on Shabbos?
Mm-hmm. Well, very often the Rebbe's teachings were given on Shabbos, mm. But there was a team of people who were able to remember every word, not only one discourse. They could remember a 6-hour gathering with the Rebbe, where the Rebbe spoke many different talks on different subjects, analyzing Talmud, discussing political events, something about women, like he would giving all kinds of discussions, analyzing Rashi on the Torah, a Kabbalistic discourse like this, and they can remember it all by heart. It's an amazing memory feat. So one of them is Simon Jacobson, who runs the Meaningful Life Institute. He was able to do this. And the most famous of all of them is Rabbi Yoel Kahn, who is a very great scholar, lives in New York, and knows, like, you know, thousands of teachings of this kind, you know, off the top of his head, straight off.
He went to Limud, you know. I think he went to Limud, Simon Jacobson.
That could be.
Yeah.
What about Remendel Vitovas as well?
Remendel was a great teacher. That wasn't his forte, if you like. You know, like, he's not remembered for his ability to be what's called a chozer. A chozer is a person who can hear and then repeat. Like, hear it and then repeat it to you. Now, this discourse, which is by the Rebbe, is very interesting, because it says, in footnote number 1, Maima zeh hua maima vayova Moshe b'toich anon telfleish nun dalet. This is almost exactly a discourse by the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe. So the Rebbe himself is repeating a discourse that was said by two Rebbeim before. So the Rebbe himself had learnt, I mean, I once heard it said, I don't know whether it was true, that when the previous Rebbe was picking a son-in-law, so what were the rules for a son-in-law? He had to know 500 discourses by heart. So the Rebbe knew 500 discourses by heart, and his brother-in-law knew 500 discourses by heart. You know, like, so that, you know, now from that, that's the beginning, if you like. That's the beginning of, you know, knowing these discourses by heart, and then reaching up to where the discourses come from, and being able to reveal your own discourse. You know, but it starts off by knowing discourses. So the Rebbe himself was a kind of a choyzer, you know, was someone who could learn a maimah and learn the whole thing. In fact, this is a very lengthy maimah, very lengthy discourse. We're not going to be able to go through the whole of it. Sometimes we have like a short thing, two, you know, 3 or 4 pages long. We can get through the whole of it. This is quite long. I hope what I will be able to share with you will make sense as a package together. We'll do enough bits of it for us to be able to understand it together. The thing is that even when the Rebbe spoke on Shabbat, so there were people who would remember by heart everything he said, and then they wrote it down, and then they would give it in. They would give it in to the Rebbe for editing. But that was a different process. When the Rebbe edited something, it often took him hours and hours and hours, like, you know, worrying about, you know, should this footnote be here or not be here, or should this line have a full stop, you know, like, and it took him hours and hours to edit. So editing was a very slow process. So in general, there was one sicha a week that he edited. And in the later years, in the 1980s, he began editing more discourses as well. So from the 1960s, I suppose, there was like one sicha a week that he edited. So that amounted to 39 volumes of edited sicha. I can't remember the exact year when it began, but let's say it was 1960, so that was 30 years of editing sicha. So that's 52 a year. So 350 to 150, that's 1,500 sicha.
1,560.
And yeah, right, thank you. so that fills 39 volumes. So how many sichot in each volume? Approximately 1,560 divided by 39, which is
11. Is it 11?
No.
By 39. Yeah. 40.
Yeah. I'd have thought it's more like I don't know. I don't know if the math is working properly. Because in each book, like in a book of Shemot, let's say, there would usually be 150 sichot. It's usually about 3 sichot for each sedra. So, and there's 53 sedras in a year, and then very often the book has extra material. So, anyway, I have to do that with the calculator, work it all out. Anyway, so that is the, so this discourse is focusing on this moment of ascending, Moses ascending. Oh, yom ba ya, yom ba ya, yom bo. Ho yira yira yo yam. Ho yam ba ya, yam ba yam ba bo. Ho yira yam ba yam ba yam ba yam. Oh, Vayavo Moshe betoch Hanan. Moses came into the cloud. Vayhi Moshe b'har 40 yom v'arba'im laila, and Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. V'amru rabotenu zal, and our sages say, v'huva b'ferush Rashi, which is quoted in Rashi's commentary, anan ze kemin ashan hu, this cloud was like smoke. V'asa lo hakadosh baruch hu shvil b'tocho, God made for him a kind of path in the smoke around the mountain. It's an interesting question. What was burning? What was the smoke from? And one suggestion, like, you know, was it the trees on the mountain? or was it somehow the rocks, you know, like, was it a smoke, like an unnatural kind of smoke?
Well, this is probably so desperate to see Hashem, so that's why I kept them going.
Go on, what did you say? He's desperate to see God.
So therefore, the smoke, that's what I heard once, that the smoke was constantly just going until eventually the Abishter saw Moshe and gave him the Torah.
You mean that despite the smoke, he's going through the smoke?
He's going through the smoke, yes.
Because he wants to come close to God. Yeah, I mean, that certainly fits with what we're learning. V'lamdu mazeh. Now this idea of a path through the smoke, that somehow or other there's this thick smoke, but there's a path through the smoke, and he goes through that path. Now, the sages learned that idea of a path. V'lamdu zeh, they learned this out. Mimash ne'amah, from what it says, Vayavo b'nei Yisrael b'toch hayam, that the Jewish people entered into the sea, the Red Sea, the splitting of the Red Sea. Now, the splitting of the Red Sea, the sages tell us that there were like channels in the sea. It wasn't just going into like dry land. The sea had dried up and it was dry land. But there's the idea of the water was a wall on either side. So in fact, the Midrash tells us there were 12 channels. Each tribe went through its own channel. So there was like a channel with a wall of water on either side, with all kinds of extra ideas that the Midrash tells us about this. So there you have the Jewish people going through the sea, ma biatam l'toch hayam, just as they're going through the sea, haital yedei shvil, was through pathways. Or a pathway. Kamosha Katuv, as it says, the actual verse says, Vahamayim lahem chomam yeminam umismolam. The water was a wall for them on their right and on their left. So the Jewish people are going through the water in a kind of pathway, with a wall of water on their right and on their left. Kach gam Moshe Katuv, Vayavo Moshe betoch anam. So also what it says, that Moses came into the cloud. So he did this through a pathway. One of the things that interests me about this is that we might think of Moses going on the mountain into this cloud or smoke, whatever it is, and the pathway that's made for him, leading him up towards God. We might think of that as the most lonely, solitary step that a human being can imagine. There is Moses alone on the mountain going towards God in this very exalted way. But this passage from the sages connects it immediately to something the entire Jewish people did going through the sea, which is not only Moses, it's everyone. Everyone is going through the sea.
Also the Yidden?
The Jewish people went through the sea. Right? Everyone went through the sea, the Red Sea, which split. So the Red Sea split.
But
and
not the 12 paths, which you were saying earlier.
Well, the following that Midrash, each tribe went through its own path. Here it's not dwelling on that. Here it's just saying that there was a path. And everyone went through that path. So it's something that belongs to the whole people. And in fact, the direction that the discourse is taking is in fact that everyone is somehow or other moving towards God, or bringing godliness here, and bringing an indwelling of godliness. Yeah, there's some sense in which Moses' spiritual experience, the most spiritual experience you could imagine, of going on the mountain, being so close to the divine and so on, is somehow being universalized, at least within the Jewish people, that this is something that in some way everyone is doing through the process of Torah and Mitzvot. There's some sense in which everyone is doing something like that. So let's see if we're able to see more of that. So then there's the concept, you know, what is this? How does it connect together? What is this pathway? How does this pathway connect together with the path in the splitting of the Red Sea? We move on to the beginning of paragraph Bet. Ulahavin ze tzarich lagdim tchila klalutin yamatan Torah shaya liyidei Moshe. To understand this, we have to understand what is the giving of the Torah which took place, which Moses was somehow bringing off. You know, it's somehow some function of the relationship of God, Moses, and the Jewish people, this whole idea of the giving of the Torah. Sheletzorech zeh, and it was in order to receive the Torah, in order to get the two tablets of stone, and to hear what all the Torah teachings are, ba betoch ha'anan, that's why he came into the cloud. Now then we have this particular power of Moshe. V'hine ita b'midrash, now it says in the Midrash, she'Moshe hu ha'shvi, Moses is the seventh. He's the seventh after Abraham. You have Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Jacob had a son called Levi. Levi had a son called Kahat. Kahat had a son called Amram, and Amram had a son called Moshe. So Moses is the seventh generation after Abraham. And being the seventh generation gives him a particular special spiritual quality. Because every seventh has a special spiritual quality. When, thank God, my wife and I, we had our seventh child, we called her Bracha. Blessing, you know, like that extra spiritual quality. And so if we look down two lines from the bottom, line 24, it says in the next to it, ukmokenu gam b'inyan hayud gimel tikunim. Now the 13 attributes of mercy, the 13 attributes of mercy which come up in the Torah in the in Parshat Kitisa, there are 13 attributes of mercy. She tikun hashvi u tikun ve'emet. The word ve'emet is the seventh one. So you have these different Hashem, Hashem, Keil, Rachum, Bechanun, etc. And then ve'emet. Da'gam shekol ha'tikunim. Even though all the attributes that these 13 attributes, they're all divine attributes, all, even though all of them are true. Over the page now. Mikol makom, nonetheless, b'inyan ha'tikunim gufa in etikun ha'shriyu b'chinat emet. Among all these attributes, the seventh one is emet, is truth. Now truth, we're now linking together the truth, which is the seventh. Moses is the seventh, he gets the Torah. So that links, it's like hyperlinks, that links truth with Torah. The emet hu inyana Torah. That's what Torah is, line 3 on the Kamay Merabotenu Zal. Ein emet elo Torah. Torah means truth. And so the idea that Moses is the seventh, umidato midat emet, and his quality is truth, as it says in the Talmud, ma ra'a, what did he see? Emet ra'a. He saw truth. V'lachein al yado davka nitna Torah. And that's why through him, through Moses, the Torah was given shehi emet, which is true. So now, there's something which is emerging here, that there is some new stage which is being revealed, being disclosed. And it is being brought about by the giving of the Torah. I mean, obviously, the giving of the Torah is a new thing. However, for the sages, there's a tradition that the patriarchs also kept Torah teaching. That's a very interesting idea. So we have the idea that Abraham, for example, kept Pesach. How could Abraham keep Pesach? His children, his great-grandchildren, had not yet gone into Egypt and had not been slaves in Egypt, and so therefore how could he keep Pesach? Nonetheless, there's the idea that the sages teach that somehow or other, either in a spiritual way, in some spiritual way, you see, the mitzvot that we see around us are practical things for the most part. However, there are spiritual dimensions, higher and higher, for each mitzvah. Anyone doing a mitzvah, that is something resonating on higher and higher level. So, for example, you may remember the intriguing incident where Jacob is trying to make the sheep give birth to speckled sheep. So he goes to the drinking troughs and he takes sticks with bark and he peels off a bit of the bark on each stick, like stripes of bark, so it looks like a stripy stick. And he puts those sticks in the water. And then the sheep come and they look at the water and they see the sticks in the water. And at the same time, they mate. And while they're mating, they see these sticks. And as a result, they have speckled young. So it's some kind of genetic engineering going on over here, which makes the lambs, which are born speckled lambs, even though both parents were ordinary white sheep or black sheep. They weren't speckled, but because they see the speckled sticks, that makes them, the children, the offspring, the young lambs become speckled. So he had a huge number of speckled sheep. The Midrash gives us all kinds of extra ideas as well, but that's in a nutshell what the verses actually say. Now, or suggest. They do say, basically. That's basically what they say. Well, the Hebrew text. Now, the sages tell us a completely further point about this. When you put on tefillin, it's like stripes. It's white and dark stripes. Well, the white arm, no, normally, it's could be a dark arm, but anyway, there's the arm, and then the black stripes of the tefillin. The arm could be any color, but the tefillin have to be black. It's a halacha le Moshe Mesinai, it's a tradition from Moses on Sinai that the tefillin have to be black, the box of the tefillin and the straps as well. So those stripes are a bit like the stripes on these bark, on these sticks with bark. So the sages say, the Midrash says, the Talmud says, that there is a sense in which Jacob was fulfilling the mitzvah of tefillin when he was doing this with the bark. Somehow or other, it was like the same kavanot, like the same spiritual something was going on a spiritual level as does now when a person puts on tefillin, except that there is an important difference. The difference between doing a mitzvah in any way one does it, before the giving of the Torah, to that of doing it after the giving of the Torah, Kabbalistically, is a fundamentally different process. It's something else happening. So, let's try and understand this.
It's like an artistic representation.
As opposed to the reality.
Well, what crystallizes as the reality.
Right. So you mean what the patriarchs did is like an artistic representation?
Yeah, in the same way that, you know, like at the forefront of the idea is an early sort of paradigm of the idea that evolves into...
Yeah, that's very interesting.
...into something that's much more marketable, I guess.
Well, that's one way of putting it. But certainly that there's like a spiritual concept.
You can't have loads of guys going out and doing the stripes and the sheep and all that. It'll kick off, wouldn't it? It'd be a bit balmy.
What's wrong with that?
No. Get out of hand.
Well, it's like a unique situation. You need the water troughs, the sheep. I mean, I can, you know, it's like this. 100 people can
into boxes, and then you know everyone's got.
Yeah, everyone can put on tefillin.
Is it like making a prototype?
Is it a prototype? Well, it's interesting. You know, all these kinds of relationships between something which is a single idealized version of something and then the practical reality of it. Mm-hmm. It could be seen as the difference between engagement and marriage. Mm-hmm.
Chazal saying that Yaakov, that he's doing something that, say, like Yitzchak and Abraham hadn't done. They hadn't, but they didn't put on tefillin.
Well, right? Now that's an interesting thing. I've never seen that point addressed. So are you saying, it's a very reasonable point that you're making, are you saying that Abraham and Isaac didn't do that? Because it tends to be the general view that everyone did everything.
Right.
However, there are certain points where it's illuminated, you know, like, so Jacob was doing tefillin like this. Could be, they would say, or one would say, analyzing this whole tradition, is that Abraham did it in some other way. Mm. How exactly, we don't necessarily know, but in some other way. That's how he did it.
Gypsies have a binding ceremony when they get married. They were binding around each other's arms.
Oh, all right.
I think there might be also like some sort of ancient sort of representation of what is binding, things like that, yeah.
Well.
But also Pesach was like an amalgamation of several different customs and festivals, so probably what they were doing was like an early evolution of Pesach. There's like Chag HaMatzot, and then there's the Paschal sacrifice, and then there's maybe that's linked to Chag HaMatzot, the springtime sort of harvest, and then the time of year.
You could like separate out different themes.
Yeah,
and see those themes as coming together. You see, with Lot, when the three angels came to Lot, it says he gave them matzah. So you could say, well, matzah is what people ate in those days. But Rashi says he gave them matzah because it was Pesach. Like, so Lot, the nephew of Abraham, was somehow keeping Pesach, even in the city of Sodom. All right, so now we're going to try and analyze the difference between the mitzvot of the patriarchs compared with the mitzvot after the giving of the Torah. Now, that begins on line 6, page Vav, line 6, Dehine. And Dehine has got a little number 12 there, where it's giving references to all kinds of backgrounds to what's going to be said over here in Hasidic teaching from earlier generations. Dehine, because behold, Av shegam ha'avot kimu kol ha'Torah ad shelo nitna. Even though the patriarchs kept the whole Torah before it was given, as it says in the Talmud in Yuma, mikol makom, nonetheless, ma'aseh avot haya reyach bilvad. The actions of the patriarchs was just a scent. Kedi'ita b'midrash, as we learn in the Midrash, kol ha'mitzvot she'asu lefanecha avot reichot hayu. All the mitzvot the patriarchs did before you, God, they were like scents, fragrant scents. Aval anu shemen turak shemecha. But we are actually pouring the fragrant oil which gives the scent. We're pouring that before you. Vahainu. Now it explores this image. Kumo areach begashmiut. Let's imagine a fragrance in physical terms. Kashem erichin ezer pri. You smell a fruit which smells nice. Or mine bosem, or some kind of spices. Lo nechsam uma be'etzem adaval yedei ze shemerichim imenu. The fact that you smell this beautiful, fragrant fruit or these spices, you're not actually taking anything away from the spices or the fruit. Lefi shehareach he'ara bilvad v'lo etzem adavar. The scent is a kind of the fragrance, it's a kind of illumination. It's not actually illumination. We would say today that the scent is really infinitesimally small particles of that object which are detected by our olfactory nerves, and therefore we interpret it as a fragrance. But in normal terms, in conventional terms, the object does not get any less just because we are smelling it. It's there, you know, a beautiful flower which smells nice, and so So, you know, one person could smell the fragrance, a million people could walk through, all smell the fragrance. Won't make any difference that we know. I mean, the flower might be very pleased that a million people are smelling its fragrance. We can't discount that possibility. But as far as we know, you know, there's all kinds of things with, you know, playing music to flowers and stuff, talking to them. But someone told me about a piece of research comparing flowers that were shouted at and flowers which were spoken to nicely. You know, and one group grew better than the other. But the ones that were spoken to nicely grew better than the other. Anyway, if as it says in last week's Sedra, it says you should walk modestly. There shouldn't, like up towards the altar, there should be a slope, not steps. Because it's somehow slightly less modest if you're walking up steps, taking large steps. So Rashi says, and if we care about the feelings of stones, how much more we should care about the feelings of people. So, you know, like when we make Kiddush on Shabbat, one of the reasons why we cover the challah with a cloth is not to put the challah to shame. Because normally the challah gets the first blessing. When you have a meal, the first thing you make a blessing on is the bread. And on Shabbat, we make it on wine first. So we cover the challah so it shouldn't see that we're making the blessing on wine. So one of my daughters always said, what's the IQ of a challah? You know, by the time you take the cover off the challah, there's a bottle of wine on the table and a glass of, you know, half-drunk wine, and everyone's got glasses of wine in front of them. What does the challah think? But, you know, who knows what it's like. Anyway, so in terms of the fragrance, it's just a fragrance which you're not taking anything really from the essence of the thing. Kach gam ma'aseh avot. So is the action of the patriarchs, that's line 13. Kol mashin shichu urak he'ara bilvad, everything they drew down into this world through their activities was only a gleam. Mashe'en ken anu, whereas in our case, shemen turak shemecha, it's the real oil, sh'al yidei kirma mitzvot, sh'achle matan torah, through keeping the mitzvot after the giving of the Torah, mamshichim et ha'etzet, we draw down the essence, which is like the oil, the fragrant oil. You've got one glass, let's say, or flask, full of a fragrant oil, and now you pour it from that flask into another flask. So, all the very essence of the oil is being poured. It's the first, it's actually pouring out into a second flask. So it is keeping the mitzvot after the giving of the Torah. It's drawing on the essence of the divine. Now, last week we explored a teaching which spoke about the way the giving of the Torah revealed the essence of the divine, and that's why the teachings of the Torah, the teachings of the Ten Commandments, are in fact very simple teachings. Because the nature of the essence is that it impregnates everything, even the, and particularly the simplest level. So here we're talking about the essence as it's being expressed through the mitzvah. Now, why is it that there is a difference between what Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did to what the Jewish people are able to do after the giving of the Torah? And so he explains, that's line 19. V'tama davahu, the reason for this is as follows. Lefi shavodat ha'avot haita b'koach atzman. The service of the patriarchs was with their own power. Now, in a sense, if you're doing something with your own power, you weren't commanded to do it, and nonetheless you're doing it with a quality of love, as Abraham did, it's a very beautiful thing. That's a very, very special thing. And there's something very wonderful about that. People, a person doing something just with their own power. And it goes on here about the way in which the patriarchs represent different aspects of the Sefirot. Because Abraham is the quality of love, which is kindness, and Isaac is the quality of severity, the way in which Abraham was traveling to the south, which there's a verse which says that, and that expresses the idea of love. Isaac is digging wells, which means some kind of like drawing the water upwards, digging wells so that the water flows upwards. That's the flow from below to above, which is like gvura, severity. And then we have Jacob, who is the quality of Tiferet, and these sticks that he cut the bark on, these sticks, in, and he took different kinds of sticks with different colors, which are white sticks and red sticks, and then the stripes on them. So all that makes the mixture of things which is like Tiferet. We're now on the next page, page Zion, line 1. So even though the service of the patriarchs was so spiritual and so beautiful, nonetheless, they weren't commanded about that. Now that's an interesting thing. They weren't commanded about it. Now there's a concept that if a person is commanded, there is a direct connection with the divine which is achieved through doing that thing. The patriarchs as yet weren't commanded. As far as commands go in their relationship with God, the only commands they had were the 7 Noahide laws. So the rules of the 7 Noahide laws applied to the patriarchs just as it applied to everyone else. But in terms of their activity, this way of like keeping mitzvot of different kinds, Pesach or whatever it might be, or tefillin, all this is before it's commanded, and so it's a beautiful fragrance, but it's in a different category. And they can, he gives an image, if you're doing something without being commanded, you can't reach higher than your own root. And he gives an image from water. Now, the actual image is something about in the time of the temple, there was a kind of a water source which was giving water to the temple. And that water flowed and came up again, but it could not come up higher than its original source. Right? Water finds its own level, that concept. And the water will come up, but only as high as the sources. That's why in a kibbutz or something, or a moshav, you have a water tower. And the water is pumped up to the top of that tower, and then it's able to feed all the taps and things in this moshav. But if you have something higher up, higher than the top of the tower, then the water pressure will suddenly drop. You won't have any pressure. So, he's using this image, that's on this page 7, Zion. He's using that image to explain the limitation of someone just working from their own energy, from their own source. Now, there's a delicate paradox here. Because after one is commanded, and one does have that spiritual connection, indeed, then we do have to do it from ourselves, you know. Not just because we're commanded, but it has to become us as well. So there's a point in which the baton, you know, if you imagine a relay race, so the baton is given to you, and then you run with the baton. So you have to have the baton yourself, but the baton has to be given to you. See, he's somehow dealing with that issue. The way in which the patriarchs were extremely spiritual, and we're reaching towards this whole beautiful dimension of Jewish practice and teaching, but that was all as a kind of a spiritual, something spiritual. Whereas what's happening with Moses and the Jewish people is that there's some tangible, concrete thing which is being given over to us in the sense of the actual having a connection with that essence. Now, let's move on to 25. The idea that the renewal, the new thing of the giving of the Torah is that through the mitzvot shemekayim min hashav, that through the mitzvot that we do now, na'aseh hamshachat ha'atzmut, we're actually drawing the essence of the divine. Muvam etzem inyan de Torah mitzvot. We can understand that idea just considering what is Torah mitzvot. Dehine inyan ha'Torah mitzvot, what's the concept of Torah mitzvot? The whole point of Torah mitzvah is to make a junction, a join between the spiritual and the physical. That's what Torah mitzvah are about. The Torah talks about physical things, like especially the commands in the Torah. Then the Talmud comes along and analyzes those commands. How exactly does it apply? Put on tefillin, it says in the Shema. V'hayu l'totafo b'enenecha. It should be in front, it's between your eyes, l'ot al yedecha, and a sign on your arm. Then comes the Talmud and explains how to make it, how to write it, how to do this, how to do that. All about it. Brings it into like complete practical reality. So after that you can actually make a sofer, a scribe, can write the parshiyot, the little parchment scrolls which go into the tefillin, and there you have And the very delicate making of the tefillin, and then you have the practical reality. So you have a physical thing. Tefillin, it comes from the parchment and the leather boxes, it all comes from the hide of an animal, whether an ox or a lamb, or a sheep. And so you've got these very, very physical things, which are being made into something spiritual and holy. And when you make tefillin, then you have a pair of tefillin. If God forbid someone drops his tefillin, he's supposed to fast. Tefillin is a very sacred thing. And then putting on the tefillin, the person is bonded with the divine in an incredible way. It's really something holy. So we've taken a piece of the physical world, a very earthly piece. I mean, if you go through the whole process and see how parchment is cured, how the skin is taken off the animal and it's kept for some time in like special kinds of chemical, and then it's taken out and stretched on a frame and it's straight. You know, you're dealing with something very, very physical, tangibly physical, and gradually it's made into this very delicate parchment, thin parchment, which is going to be used for the writing of tefillin. So it's something delicate, but becoming something very, very sacred. So that is really joining together the border between the physical and the spiritual. Now, that border between the physical and the spiritual, I mean, leaping, you know, 10 pages to the end of the discourse, that's actually what the path for Moses is. The path of Moses going up the mountain, and the having gone up, he's gone up the mountain, now there's this thick cloud or smoke, and there's a pathway which opens. So in other words, the smoke represents a kind of dense and impenetrable spirituality. You know, you can't go there. Man cannot see me and live. That's the no-go area, because God is infinite and you can't approach. And then there is a pathway, so you can approach. So that's, you know, so it's taking humanness and the ability to approach the divine. Now that's what tefillin is, or any other mitzvah. The mitzvah is that it comes to us as a human being. We're a physical human being. The mitzvah comes, as it were, loaded with spiritual energy, and we somehow get involved with doing that mitzvah, whatever it is, putting on tefillin, having a mezuzah on the door. And we are being included in that spiritual dimension. We're being wrapped up in the divine. And what's beautiful about this discourse is the way that it's really comparing that to Moses going up the mountain. Each one of us, whenever we're carrying out any mitzvah, is in some sense going up the mountain, connecting with God. which also relates to the going through the Red Sea, going through the sea which is split, and which was really a visionary experience as well. It was like a prophetic experience that people had, like, it says that a maidservant saw at the splitting of the sea a deeper level of prophecy than some of the greater prophets, the greatest prophets later on. So there's this visionary dimension in the splitting of the sea, in Moses going up the mountain, and in us, any man or woman carrying out a mitzvah of the Torah, is also entering into their own private visionary and spiritual dimension of the joining of the physical and the spiritual. So that idea of joining the material, physical with spiritual, now how can that happen? How can you join the physical and spiritual? They're two opposites. V'yodua, now that's line 29, the penultimate line on this page. V'yodua, and it's known, shechibur gashmi v'ruchniyut, the joining of the physical and the spiritual, hu b'koich ha'mafli la'asot dafka, comes from the wondrous power of shehu b'koich ha'atzmut, the wondrous power of the essence of the divine. It's the essence of the divine beyond the world, beyond the physicality and the spirituality together, who is able to join together those two opposite dimensions so that they become one. So that we are able to do this physical action which somehow bonds us to the inwardness of the divine.
It's like when you have a piece of cake and you want to make a bracha. How do you connect yourself to make a brocha, to have a piece of cake? What makes him say the brocha? So, is that the answer, what you just said, basically, is the wondrous of the essence of...
Well, you see, that's...
Isn't that like the same moshul? Well,
that's an interesting thing. You see, there you have a very physical thing, a piece of cake. Then you have the blessing that the person's going to say over the piece of cake, which is a very spiritual thing. And what makes... You see, you're asking, Simcha, what makes the person want to say the bracha? Why does the person want to say the blessing? Because he or she knows that the Torah says that when you eat food, you should say a blessing. So it's somehow coming from this higher dimension. And what is that higher dimension really? It's coming from the essence of the divine. The essence of the divine is putting together the person, the piece of cake, and God. And somehow making a shidduch out of the whole lot. So you eat a piece of cake, and you're saying a blessing, blessed are you, O God, and when you go into all the meanings, what there is, the meaning of a blessing, it's drawing down godliness into this world, step by step, Baruch, drawing down. Baruch represents a kind of a flow downwards. Ata, you, God, who are beyond everything, Hashem, and then we have the word, the name of God, which is an exalted name, and then Elokeinu, which is another word for God, which is more closer to us in this world. Melech, king, which is even closer. Ha'olam, of the world. You know, like, it's like drawing down step after step after step. And then we say what he does. He creates the fruit of the vine, let's say. He makes grapes. And grapes become wine, and so therefore we're saying this blessing, Bore Priya Geffen, on a glass of wine. So at that moment there's a tremendous spiritual interaction taking place. That's you know, of course, unfortunately, you could say, you know, very often a person makes a blessing without really thinking very much about what they're doing, you know, blah blah blah. They're having an apple, you know.
Mine is more focused on the cake than the bracha itself.
But nonetheless, the fact that we say the blessing, it gives the opportunity for the mind to be a little bit more aware of what it's saying, and including all these spiritual teachings which are within that. So there we have a joining together of physicality and spirituality, which comes about through the power of the essence. So therefore, there is a kind of a linking up of the essence. So that's now on page Ches, it connects with a teaching that we explored a couple of weeks ago. The whole idea that originally the essence of the divine was in the world, that's with Adam and Eve, and then through the sin of Adam and Eve, somehow the essence departed, going higher and higher away, and then we have the drawing back of this divine quality back into the world, and we are doing it. And we're achieving this indwelling of the divine in the world because we have this link to the essence. It's the essence which is enabling us to have the link to holiness, so that our physical lives and the cake that we eat and everything else we do somehow can be formatted in such a way that it becomes an expression of divine, of holiness here in this world. Okay, so now we go to, so it's Moses who achieved this through setting up the sanctuary, and in the sanctuary, in the Holy of Holies, there is the divine presence. Now, if we go to section Gimel, which is on page Chet, section Gimel, we're going to see the same twist, as it were, that this discourse keeps doing, going from Moses, the unique individual, to the entire Jewish people. That somehow that unique quality is being bequeathed, is being shared with the entire Jewish people. V'hine amshachat ha'atzmut, now the drawing down of the essence of the divine. Shehim sheikh Moshe lamato, which Moses draw down below, b'tachtonim, into the lower world. Hitgaluta hi al yedei nishmot Yisrael. The revealing of this is through the Jewish souls. That's why it says they should make for me a sanctuary and I'll dwell within them. It doesn't say I'll dwell within it. It says within them, inside every single individual Jewish man and woman, there is the indwelling of the divine. Hainu. That means shenishmot Yisrael, that the Jewish souls, al yedei avodatam v'itkafya v'idhafcha, through their service of God. Now, the service of God, you can say it's got two dimensions in general. One is the struggle. The struggle that's involved.
To do it.
You know, beginning with a struggle to get out of bed in the morning. And all the way through the day, you might say there are different kind of opportunities, different aspects of mitzvah. And each one, it's a struggle this way or it's a struggle that way. You know, either the mitzvah is telling us not to do something and we have a little struggle about that. Or it's telling us we should do something and we have a little struggle about that as well. So there's the struggle element of the mitzvah. Now, what's interesting about this discourse, and it's like a whole, cross-section of Chabad Hasidic teachings, is that this struggle dimension we might negate. It's quite easy for us to say, oh, well, if I have such a struggle about it, you know, it's not really me. But the interesting thing is the discourse is saying, you know what, it's because it's such a struggle, that's what it's really about. That's where, you know, it's as if you're, you know, rubbing two flints together and some are getting a spark. You won't get the spark without the friction. So it's that very struggle which is the essence of what we are actually trying to achieve. There's even a very subtle and in a way rather esoteric idea that if we do something naturally, that's not enough. We have to push that to the point where there is some sort of effort. You know, the level that a person enjoys. See, that's the other dimension. There's struggle and enjoyment. Now, it's wonderful to enjoy mitzvot. I mean, that's a very beautiful thing. Mitzvot, Torah, it's all the most beautiful fun. You know, a person who can say he spends his entire life on holiday. You know, what's he doing? He's doing what he enjoys. Swimming, sitting in the sun, bit of riding, you know, whatever people like doing on holiday, you know, skiing. So what do you like doing? Putting on tefillin, learning these fascinating learning fascinating teachings, yeah. What else could they, you know, it's great, you know, this is the life, you know. Well, what more can you want? But
people like to see the outcome as well.
Well, there are lots of different outcomes. The ultimate outcome is Mashiach coming. So you want to see that. What outcome would you suggest?
Drive people mad, you know, see how they react. Things like that. Okay. Playing a game of chess, who can win?
Rather than play a big, massive tefillin box and large elastic black straps.
Right.
So you could do that, like roll it down Golders Green High Street, and you could dump people in the box. Maybe park it next to the Lubavitch van or something, and then people get all caught up in the straps. They're like elastic, and you can like fight with them. And it's like a web. Yeah. It's on wheels as well, the box, so you can trundle down the road.
You're going there upside down.
Huh?
Upside down.
Push people along in it.
Well, it reminds me of a Yiddish saying that my grandfather used to say. Ob de Bubba hat gehad redlich, if grandmother would have had wheels, wo mir gefort in Oxford Street. She would have driven in Oxford Street. You know, possibilities. So, there's actually a poem by Chernyakhovsky which describes God being caught up in tefillin. So, so there we have this idea of, you see, there's struggle and there's inspiration. Now, ultimately, the idea is that struggle leads to inspiration, and inspiration is where it's really at. And most Chabad teachings talk in that way. That really, you go beyond struggle. Struggle is okay at an earlier part of, development. But eventually you get to inspiration. And through contemplation, through all kinds of like extra spiritual dimensions, you don't have a struggle, you're inspired. And when you're inspired, everything is easy. But there's an additional knetch, there's an additional little fillip somehow in Chabad thought, that inspiration, pure inspiration, can become just somehow indulgent, self-centered. You know, there's a sense in which inspiration is for oneself and might leave out other people. And one has to be able to make the step which is beyond that and which includes other people. And that might be making a step beyond one's own personal inspiration. You know, one can be drunk on one's own inspiration. And that can be to the exclusion of others. So that's the danger.
This reminds me of a teaching from Rabbi Nachman that we're always either, I think he calls it running or returning. Mm. So it's like, you're either moving in the right direction, nice and easy, in which case you have a certain thing to do, which is make sure you keep doing that. Or you're doing the difficult job of picking yourself up because you've fallen.
Mm. Yeah.
There's like you're either in one of those places. Or,
yeah. Right. Yeah. That seems very comfortable. Yeah. Right. So there we have. So this revelation in this world is, I think, let's go on to page 9. This revelation of godliness in this world, that really is the purpose of creation, that there should be the task of this struggle and of this inspiration, and, you know, both, if you like, which it says in line 7, that in fact it's the struggle which is the introduction which leads towards the inspiration. He puts it there. And through that, we're drawing down the essence. So we're drawing down the essence through the process of keeping Torah and mitzvot.
Do you think people, like, do this in different avenues of their life so that they... You don't really win in life, do you? You kind of achieve it in one thing, and then you kind of... Then you kind of start again with another thing, and you're different. So on some levels you might be quite inspired and inspiring others, and others you might be really...
I think that's a very, very neat, very interesting perspective. Because indeed we do have fragmented personalities and life. And it's quite true that people are a tremendous mixture. And so in one domain, you're quite right. One domain they might be inspired. Another they might be struggling. And in another it could be that they're betrayed. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that's a very profound perception. You know, it would be nice if people were consistent, you know, through and through. You know, some are, and that's an ideal. You know, like, I think a person like Mendel Fudafast was consistent. That's right. Yes, this gentleman over here on the right of this picture, he was a great teacher who, thank God, I knew. And a very, very inspiring person. And, you know, generally people felt about him, he was a totally consistent person. But such people are very rare. And most people are a bit of this and a bit of that. And would fit very well into one of your pictures.
Well, I was thinking about that today, like the Lubavitch idea, if everyone puts on tefillin, then you know, everything, if at the, you know, everyone, all the Jews that have to put on tefillin, and then everything will be alright. And whether that's the you know, the main goal, or if it's about actually Jews, if all the Jews are actually good and did
well, you see, that's a very good point. The Lubavitch Rebbe spoke about 10 mitzvah campaigns. The first of those is love your neighbor. Ahavat Yisrael. And love your neighbor can be expressed in a million different ways. And can sometimes be the most challenging thing to do. It's just everyone around you to express love, goodness to them, being a good person. One of those mitzvot is tefillin. You know, so some of the mitzvot are like, you could say, well, that's a simple thing. You know, a person puts on tefillin. But putting on tefillin is also a whole world. You know, for one individual, it's just a matter of putting it on. Another one, it's a matter of deep feeling at the same time. If one puts on tefillin, and then an hour later does some very nasty thing to someone else, you know. The tefillin are supposed to be making us into better people as well. You know, so the full effect of the tefillin does relate to what kind of people we are. And then there are other mitzvot. There's having a mezuzah, there's giving charity. Now, giving charity is a whole realm. Could be giving money, could be giving time, could be giving affection, could be phoning someone up. All different varieties of charity. That's could be giving medical help. It's just simply a person giving something of themselves to others. And so there are many different dimensions. So, you know, it's not just one thing. There are lots of different dimensions. One is learning Torah. There's no limit to learning Torah. I was always impressed by the way that the first was love of one's fellow, because that's like an entrance to which everything else makes sense. All right. So we've got, trying to analyze this discourse together, we've got these three dimensions. I mean, you see, the discourse doesn't put it like this. It's me analyzing it, as it were. You got Moses on the mountain going through the thick clouds, through a pathway, coming closer to God. You got the Jewish people going through the sea, which is split in a miraculous way, and which is a visionary and amazing experience, like prophecy. And then you've got a Jewish person carrying out the mitzvot of the Torah, running a kosher kitchen, lighting candles for Shabbat, putting mezuzot on the doors. Any little teaching that the Talmud says, washing one's hands when one wakes up in the morning, you know, the whole idea, Nagelwasser. And all of them are about the contact between the physical and the spiritual. He's going to talk about that, but you see, obviously going up the mountain, you've got there this entry of a human being from the world of human beings entering into the mountain, the cloud, the smoke, the hiding of the divine. You know, beyond that is the infinite divine. And you have it in the Red Sea, the sea, the splitting of the sea. The sea represents spirituality. The dry land is our ordinary physical existence. And the splitting of the sea, suddenly the revealing of the dry land in the sea and being able to walk on the dry land, is another expression of the bonding of the physical and the spiritual. And when we do a mitzvah, that's also what we are doing. And we're creating that indwelling of the divine here in this world. Now, what he says on line 9, page test, line 9. He quotes footnote 30, Jeremiah 7:4. Suddenly, in this verse, Jeremiah 7:4, it says, Heichel Havai, Heichel Hashem, Heichel Hashem, Heichel Hashem. The temple of God, the temple of God, the temple of God. Three times. Hema, they are. They are the temple of God. The Jewish people are three times the temple of God. Why? And then comes the whole concept of the way that through the Jewish people keeping the Torah in this world, we are manifesting what the temple is, because the temple is an indwelling of the divine. You could say that's another image in this collection of images. There's Moses on the mountain. There's the going through the splitting of the sea. There is the sanctuary and the Holy of Holies and the divine presence in the sanctuary. And then there's a divine presence in each person's heart and in each person's life, the mitzvot which surround each individual. You know, so it's like four interchangeable images. And one of them is Moses on the mountain. And I find it very beautiful that this sort of loneliest moment in the Torah is somehow being shared with everyone, that we are all part of that, you know. And it's the idea that Moses is not just Moses. Moses is the leader of the Jewish people. And because of that, everyone has a Moses inside them. There's a concept that Moses is in our own soul as well. And so Moses on the mountain is part of our experience going back. You dig deeper, it's part of us. Now, then we have the way in which the mitzvot have spiritual qualities. And if we go on to page 10, he talks about a number of different mitzvot, the way in which each mitzvah is like communicating something. So he starts off with an esrog, the etrog. Now the etrog, of course, we use on Sukkot, shaking the four kinds with the etrog, the lulav, and so on. But the Etrog, line 3, has the Rosh Tevod. It spells the word Al Tavoeini Regel Ga'ava. Don't let the foot of pride come to me, says God. So the Etrog represents the opposite of pride. Why does the Etrog represent that? Because the mysterious thing about an Etrog, a citron, botanically, is that unlike most other fruits, or any fruits that I've heard of, the Etrog dar bi'ilano mishana l'shana, an Etrog remains on the tree from year to year. Now, you see, most fruit, they ripen, they start off a little fruit, then it gets ripe, and once it's ripe, it drops off the tree, that's the end of it. And if you keep it, if you somehow stop it from falling off the tree, it doesn't get bigger. I'm not quite sure exactly what happens to an apple if you keep it hanging from the tree. But it doesn't become a huge apple like that. I suspect it goes moldy. I don't know what happens to it. Have to try and find out. But an Etrog, if you support an Etrog so that it doesn't pull itself off the tree by its own weight, it actually gets bigger and bigger. I've seen Etrog as big as like a rugby football. It's so it can get so big that it's not kosher anymore for the mitzvah, because you've got to be able to hold it in one hand. You know, so if the Etrog gets so big you can't hold it in one hand, then there's a problem. But the idea that the Etrog goes on growing on the tree. Now, what happens on the tree? The tree is going through different seasons. Spring, I mean, that's the normal time we pick the Etrog. Spring, summer, autumn, winter. And the Etrog is going through those different seasons. So, it's like a person. Imagine a person going through different seasons. There might be some seasons you like, some seasons you don't like, but you accept it all. The Etrog grows from every experience, so to speak. It's like a person who grows even from negative experiences, makes them grow bigger. Now that's a remarkable thing. And that really comes about through what's called bittul. Bittul means a kind of a selflessness, that one's own self is not the focus. The focus is something else, might be another person, might be. But the one's own self is not filling the screen. And to be able to achieve that in life is a very wonderful thing, because that is a true freedom from the self. And the Etrog represents that. And the idea that one is able to bear everything, any kind of change. You know, there are people who are thrown, something unusual happens, they're completely thrown by it. And, you know, God forbid, there are terrible things that happen in life. Some of them destroy people's personalities, you know, quite apart from physically destroying
them. People have an effect out of it.
Hmm?
People have effect out of these things.
They are,
them, yeah.
It affects them. Yeah, well, it can affect them in a paralyzing way, in a very destructive way. Like Viktor Frankl, his work in the concentration camps was to attempt to give people a purpose in life so that they would survive at this moment. Because a common problem was people not surviving simply because they saw no purpose in being alive. They couldn't see any reason to live. They'd seen everyone they love around them shot, killed, and now here they are in a concentration camp. Life is completely meaningless. Why should they live? And Frankl tried to help people see that there is a purpose, or you know, for them.
What
you
was
know,
he was
an inmate in a concentration camp, but he was a psychotherapist, and he worked to help people survive by talking with them and discussing what is it that you want to do. You know, so someone might say, well, I've got an aunt in Montreal, you know, what I'd like to do is get free from here when the war ends and get to see my aunt in Montreal. So it's a great, you know, let's focus on that, your aunt in Montreal. You know, he says that when he was dealing with religious people, they often had a whole packet of purpose already, and it was easier to bring to the fore. But it didn't have to necessarily be a religious purpose, but just the sense of, you know, I'm going to see my aunt in Montreal. That could give a person reason to live and take them through the unspeakable horror they were going through and enable them to just, you know, just keep focused in order to live another day, which was the great challenge. To try to live another day despite the incredible pain and horror that was there. So that's the quality of an etrog. And it's interesting that the word that the pre-eats hadar, this word, the etrog, is called hadar. Now there is a series of kings. A series of kings which these kings represent a very deep thing in Kabbalah. They're the kings of Edom, and there are different kings, and they represent the breaking of the vessels, the Shvirat HaKelim, the breaking of the vessel. And then you get one of these kings is called Hadar. Now Hadar is similar to the word Hadar, which is used for the fruit, for the etrog. And this Hadar, he is described as, he's one of these kings, he's the eighth king. And he's described, this is line 12, Hu Shoresh HaTikun. He is the source of repair. There's the breaking of the vessels, and in the which is the cause of the origin of evil. You know, when you go into what is the, according to the Kabbalah, what is the origin of evil? So, one dimension, the beginning dimension is the breaking of the vessels. The breaking of the vessels, this Kabbalistic concept right at the beginning of existence, that the radiance was too intense for the vessels. The vessels couldn't contain that radiance. But then you have, within the breaking of the vessels, you have the root of tikkun. You have the root of healing. And that is like the etrog. So the etrog, which is called the pre-eats hadar, the fruit, the beautiful fruit. Hadar means beautiful. And hadar is also the name of this eighth king. So therefore, because what is tikkun? What is the repair? It is the selflessness and the including of all different dimensions, the ability to absorb differentness and oppositeness. That's a crucial thing, that a person can be confronted by that which is other, that which is the opposite, and they're able to relate to it. That's the selflessness and the spirituality of the etrog. And that's the dimension that the mitzvah of shaking lulav and etrog is supposed to inculcate in us, that there's this extra dimension. So in this way, he goes through etrog, through tefillin in which we are bonding our mind and our hearts. He talks about tzitzit, wearing of tzitzit, which is a way, on the one hand, tzitzit represents all the mitzvot and the way in which we accept God as king, through the mitzvot, so tzitzit represent acceptance, but also the word tzitzit means glimpsing, meitzitz min achalakim, glimpsing through the lattice, and it's glimpsing the beauty, the radiance of godliness. You know, so tzitzit has both those dimensions. On the one way, acceptance, and on the other hand, the most tremendous inspiration, seeing the glimpsing, this radiance of godliness. And so there is the drawing down of the divine into the world. That's what we're doing through the quality of doing, keeping Torah mitzvah. But in order to draw the divine into this dark and gloomy world, which is a world where the divine is hidden, We need to reach towards the essence above in order to do it. So there has to be that reaching towards the essence. And that's the, that's the sense in which we are, you know, how do we draw down the essence? He actually talks about the saying of the Shema. When we say the Shema, which is the first line of the Shema, is kind of the upper unity, reaching to that point where there's only godliness. There's nothing apart from God. And then we have the Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto Lo'olam Vayed, the second line of the Shema, where we're recognizing godliness in the world. That is the expression of a kind of a reaching towards the essence, that we're able to achieve these two different dimensions virtually at the same time. Now then we come on page 14, Yud Dalet, at the bottom of the page, to a quoting of a fascinating passage where the sages compare the people going through the Red Sea, where suddenly switching to them, right? That's one of our four images. Moses on the mountain, the Jews at the splitting of the sea, the temple and that image, and then a Jew carrying out mitzvot today. So now we're looking at the people of the sea, and there's a striking image which relates to something you said, Simcha. Moses was yearning to see godliness. And in this midrash it says, the people going across the sea did see godliness. They saw godliness. What Moses was yearning to do when he was on the mountain, everyone was able to achieve in this incredible way through that particular gap. So that splitting of the sea, and somehow it was a revelation. So it goes through a whole thing here of to what extent is God hidden. God is hidden in the revealed worlds, but then there's hidden worlds. And in those hidden worlds, somehow there's further and further levels of revelation of godliness. So you could say that the splitting of the sea made the hidden world, made us enter the hidden world. The sea represents the hidden world. The hidden world is like the letters Yud and He of the divine name. And Vav and He of the divine name is the revealed world, is the world that we normally live in. And what happened with the splitting of the sea is that somehow we're entering the realm of Alma de Itkaskia, the realm of hiddenness, which is the first two letters of the divine name. And there, godliness was revealed. And Moses on the mountain, he is yearning for that kind of revelation. And that's then goes a whole discussion, you know, about different aspects of the prophecy and the awareness of Moses. Now, finally, we come on page 16 to the idea that the splitting of the Red Sea is actually a preparation for the giving of the Torah. Because that splitting of the sea, that dimension of revelation that was revealed to everyone, that's really the preparation for the Torah, for the giving of the Torah. And the way in which we walked in a path through the sea, that is a preparation for Moses walking through the path up the mountain. And then that all becomes the preparation for us in our own personal lives, representing and expressing the revelation of the essence within our lives, and expressing that in our daily world. And so if we look at the last page, on page 18, V'zeo v'ayova Moshe b'tocha anan, that's what it means, Moses came within the cloud. That means that for the sake of the revelation of the giving of the Torah, which is a revelation of the essence, there had to be a garment which would receive the Torah, which comes enclosed in a garment, and that garment is the cloud. That's the cloud around the mountain. It's the cloud which is the garment of the Torah, and the smoke is like a parable. You see, the Torah works through parables, and the smoke or the cloud is like a parable. That's the way the Torah works. The Torah is a parable for the divine. And when we read the parable, which is in the Torah, what's actually entering us, what we're really bathing in, is this infinite illumination of the divine. And so that, and the purpose is that the essence should be revealed below. And so when it says that the Jewish people went into the sea, it means they were going into that hidden realm, and that hidden realm should radiate into the revealed realm. And that's, and similarly with the giving of the Torah, that there's a path through which the radiance shines below. As it says about Abraham and his descendants, they will keep the path of God to do charity and justice. The charity and justice, in other words, the mitzvah, they are the path and the corridor, the shvil, the little track, to draw down the name of God into the world through the Torah and the mitzvah. There's a revelation of the essence here in this world. But now, at this moment, it's not yet revealed. But it will be revealed. As it says, the glory of God will be revealed. V'nigla kvod Hashem, v'ruhu kol basar yachdav, and all flesh will see together, ki pi Hashem diber, that the mouth of God speak.
Long one.
It is.
So maybe the cloud was like wrapped 7 times round the mountain.
You could think of it like that.
The spirals.
Yeah.
Like
the tefillin strip.
So, let's just think about Moses. There's an idea of ascended masters in mediumship, where great teachers, great righteous people, that when they pass on into spirit, they are able to gravitate up the celestial realms into almost not quasi-divine, but almost like angel-like status, like they're very close to God in their spirituality. And so yeah, just responses to that, and also think about Moses, what the journey he was going, but in his own, he was doing it in his physical life, as opposed to in the next world.
Yeah, there's that point. And also there's the idea that Moses and other great people, after they pass away, retain a connection with the Jewish people. That there's still that connection, just as Moses' job, as it were, while he was in the world, was to connect to the Jewish people with God. That continues after he passes away as well. So there's a beautiful section of Tanya, the fourth part of Tanya, chapter 27, which talks about the spiritual effect of a tzaddik after they've left the world, and how this effect still continues, in a sense gets bigger, because they've left the world, the way in which they are helping others. So it's not just a matter of Moses going higher and higher away and becoming some sort of you know, we have various images of, you know, angel-like figures, you know, Chanoch, or, you know, the certain things in earlier Kabbalah, whereas the emphasis is generally not just on being on a very high plane, but of connecting below, because the goal is to somehow connect what is very exalted to below in this world.
Yeah.
Okay.